From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This week we bring you the final talk from this year's Turing Education Day. Professor Kevin Warwick and Huma Shah explain the Turing test in a talk called Turing and Artificial Intelligence.
We're really looking now at the Turing test. Alan Turing, he's done all sorts of things that he was involved with. Well, in the field of artificial intelligence, the Turing test is a well-known milestone. There's all sorts of philosophical arguments about what it proves, what it doesn't prove, etc., etc. In a sense, I'm going to skim through some of the philosophy, sprinkle it in as we go through. The main thing that Huma and I are going to look at are practical tests. The whole basis of this Turing test is based on what Turing himself called the Turing imitation game, is to get a machine, and really he was saying this back in 1950, so he was looking ahead, and to get a machine, a computer, to pretend to be a human in a conversation, to fool you, the interrogator, so that you can't tell the difference. The machine's performing. So you're going to have to perform a little bit yourself. We're going to put you on trial as much as anything else. Just one or two things to start with. Turing had posed this, as we've heard before, as an experiment, an argument, rather than answering the question, can machines think? This was a test. Rather along the same lines, if you look at the person next to you and to decide, does that person think? How will you decide that, okay, they look human and all that sort of stuff, but how can you test? And it's that sort of, ask them a few questions, see how they answer. It's like an interrogation as you would get in an interview procedure. But very much the sort of first few minutes, that is what Turing was looking at. One thing I don't think anybody from has covered today is the Ratio Club. This is something that Turing belonged to. This was a dining club. They used to have a few drinks as well, to be honest. They used to meet up regularly, sort of intellectuals that would talk and chat about all sorts of stuff. Here, of course, is Alan Turing sitting on the front. But as we've heard, quite a few other people that were around working with Turing at the time are still around today, and that's true here. And in the picture, Horace Barlow is still up at Cambridge. This guy is now Sir Giles Brindley. I won't go into exactly what he got up to, but it was something to do with chemicals and male erections and things like that. But now Sir Giles Brindley, so it obviously worked. I think the one, just because as it affects myself and humour, this guy here is John Westcott, who's very much still alive at the moment. He also happened to be my PhD supervisor. And as Huma was my PhD student, he's sort of Huma's PhD grandfather, as it were. So a direct relationship, if not myself, with Alan Turing, at least through somebody who knew Alan Turing. One or two key points. The Turing test gives an indication of machine abilities, and particularly to do with conversation. It also, though, gives an indication of human limitations. Because it is a machine, if you like, in competition, it's trying to fool you into believing it's a human, but it's up against a human. And not only you, the interrogator, if we put it that way, are human, and therefore not perfect, the human that it's competing against also is human, and therefore has blemishes and so on. Which I think some philosophers haven't spotted, that not all humans are absolutely perfect. The basic competition, as it were, is, as we've heard, hidden, so the machine and human can't be seen by the interrogator. and it's a machine competing against a hidden human. And as we will see, the interrogator conclusions, when you look at official tests, can be completely biased, certainly are prejudiced. People bring all sorts of assumptions as to how poor the machine is and how wonderful humans are. They can be way off the mark, and in some cases, as we said, just plain silly. You couldn't imagine making such a conclusion yourself. Now, Turing's predictions. And I'll try and translate this, because even this is not that easy. This is what he actually said back in 1950, which is why we get that he was saying that the machines are going to pass the imitation game in 50 years. I believe that in about 50 years' time, he said, it will be possible to program computers to make them play the imitation game so well that an average interrogator, whatever that means, will not have more than a 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. So the Turing test is all about a very, very quick 5 minute thing. It's not, you know, if you've got to make a decision about another person, if you have half an hour to talk to them, you've got a bit of time to probe. 5 minutes is quite a quick fire thing. That's what he said in 1950. He then, as we've heard, subsequently said about the 100 years. It's going to be at least 100 years that a machine will be able to respond to an interrogator like a human does. So he probably qualified what he said. But even then, he was talking about 50 years. And we will see how good they are. I think I'm going to hand over to Huma.
So in 1950, he described two scenarios in order to stage his imitation game. One was a direct test where one judge talks to one hidden entity and tries to determine from unrestricted questions whether they're human or machine. And then he also described the simultaneous test, which is the one that people seem to think is the standard Turing test, where one judge is simultaneously interrogating two hidden entities, one a machine, one a human, and tries to determine which is which. Pictorially, this is how the first test, one-to-one, would be. We've got Alan Turing speaking to his robot, or trying to determine that it's a robot. The second scenario, you have a judge. They're sitting in front of a terminal which has a split screen. Each of the split screens is connected to a hidden entity, and the judge is chatting to both of these hidden entities at the same time. In 5 minutes, whether it's the one-to-one or the simultaneous, it's 5 minutes, and the reason why I believe Turing wrote 5 minutes is because we do form an impression. We form a first impression with thin slice of behaviour. So 5 minutes is enough. So the judge is, in this scenario, is chatting to two hidden entities and has to determine which one of left or right is human or machine. First impression, thin slice, and that's enough. And there's lots of psychological studies to show that the longer you get, it just confirms your initial impression. In other words, it's harder to change your mind. Last week, Bletchley Park kindly allowed us to host the biggest Turing test contest in history on the 100th anniversary of Alan Turing's birth. What we're going to present here today is one of the Turing tests from there. Now, what were the judges told? They have to uncover all the machines and all the hidden humans. There were 180 tests conducted, 30 judges, 6 children, and 24 adults. So each of them were asked to uncover all the machines. If they decided that, yes, I'm speaking to a machine, we asked them to give them a conversational ability score from 0 to 100, where 0 is like really poor machine-like, and 100 is like human-like. Also, identify the humans, and also were they talking to a male, female, age range, child, teenager, adult, and native English or non-native English. So some features, if they could, extract from that conversation. So we also asked them to treat the interactions as if they were speaking to a stranger. We didn't want them to trick stupid questions like we did see, that, you know, I'm going to bake some crisps, do I have to call a fireman? I mean, those kind of questions were used, but we did ask them to treat the interactions as if they were speaking to a stranger. How would you speak to a stranger? What were the hidden humans told? They were asked not to make it easy for the machines, that it was the machines who were trying to deceive the human judges, that they're the human. So we asked the hidden humans, be yourselves, don't answer in a robotic fashion. Okay, so underneath your chairs, we've left a sheet of paper, if you wouldn't mind. So this is a transcript from one of the Turing tests last week. What I'd like you to do is to read the transcript. the same judge is talking to two hidden entities, entity one, entity two. What I'd like you to do is, where it's got HM unsure, could you tell me whether they're human or machine? You've got two choices. The entities could either be two humans, two machine, or one human, one machine. If you think it's one human, one machine, can you tell me which side the machine is?
And it's really worth having a go at it. Well, you have to have a go. I mean, if you don't have a go, it plays into the hands of the machine, because you have to get the right identification is the point. If you don't, Turing specifically said the right identifications. For those of you that are quick off the mark, you can also try and spot the judge. We will give a clue that the judge was human. So I wouldn't mind another guess. Was the judge male or female?
I was wondering if the judge was a machine.
We've spoiled it, I'm afraid, Whitfield. It's
a cyborg option.
Yeah. In the future, we will have lots of cyborg. There won't be humans involved. Going over one or two points, the whole game, which he called a game, which has become known as the Turing test, generally a human is at one terminal and you've got a hidden machine and a hidden human that you can't actually see and so on. You're apart, and the idea, as you've now seen, is to decide which is the machine, which is the human. One or two thoughts before we go into this, because some of you may feel human creativity would test it on one or two things. We'll challenge that in a second. I've got a nice little quote from Agatha Christie, which I think is appropriate. This is actually a quote from Hercule Poirot. The man is an unoriginal animal. It's something to remember. Machines can be extremely creative. And the other thing, which is from Mark Twain, that is very much appropriate, it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they've been fooled. And I've found this certainly talking to computer scientists. They don't really want to admit if they get it wrong. They find all sorts of arguments as to why they didn't really get it wrong, even when they have got it wrong. I'm just going to give a translation of the test, because Turing, it wasn't so easy to pick up. But this is really what it means if we're looking at it. A machine can be said to have passed the Turing test if an average interrogator, and that is a fuzzy concept, has a 30% chance or more of making the wrong identification after 5 minutes of paired questioning. So what it means, a wrong identification means it's not the right identification. The right identification would be to say, this is the machine, and it is the machine, this is the human, and it is the human. Anything else is wrong. So if you know this is the machine and it is, and you're unsure about the other, then it's a point to the machine, effectively, as far as Turing was concerned. And the machine must fool at least 30% of the interrogators, so you don't know exactly which is which. One thing looking, it's not really just looking at getting a machine to fool you into thinking it's human. It has to fool you into thinking it's more human than the human, because it's competing against a human. So it is a difficult task. If you actually have two humans there, you're getting each of them competing to say they're more human than the other person. So the machine is actually trying to fool you that it is more human than the human. So it's a tough test for machines. It is a tough test. And Turing could see that. This is his quote, or quotes of his words. The game may be criticised because the odds are weighed too heavily against the machine. He made a comment, so not everybody agrees with this, which is interesting. If the man were to try and pretend to be the machine, he would clearly make a poor showing. So this is, you know, if you're being tested on mathematical things and so on, you wouldn't be able to compete. I concur with him. But not everybody does, because if you throw time into this as another variable, then it's not necessarily the case. Is it a test for human intelligence? A lot of people feel it is. The Turing test shows in some way that machines are intelligent, perhaps like a human. Well, some people. The test provides a guarantee, not of intelligence, but of culturally oriented human intelligence. You know, it's language based, so there's nuances, is the culture involved. So that's the sort of thing you're looking at. Turkle from MIT assigns intelligence to machines. A general tendency to treat responsive computers as more intelligent. And I think quite commonly people do nowadays talk of machines as being intelligent. And Hannard, Turing test sets artificial intelligence's empirical goal. It's not just a game. So to quite a few philosophers, this is a critical milestone in the field of artificial intelligence. What does the test actually test? Turing posed the game instead of asking the question, can machines think? So effectively saying, if a machine can pass the test as we know it, we have to admit, I can't say it doesn't think. You never have to say it thinks, in terms of the same sort of way as how a human thinks. Perhaps the test therefore indicates that a machine appears to think if it passes the test. If it doesn't, or if a human doesn't, then that's another question. And the whole thing, if you test another human, how can you know that they think? They just appear to think from the outside, unless you get into their brain and so on. Turing not only came up with this test, he also made some what I believe to be profound comments on intelligence and artificial intelligence. I'll just pick one or two of them because I like to have a go at one or two philosophers when I can. And one of the things he said, which I feel is bang on, and remember this is 1950, way ahead of his time, intelligent behaviour presumably consists in a departure from the completely disciplined behaviour involved in computation, but just a slight one, which does not give rise to random behaviour or to pointless repetitive loops. So he's picking up on things which nowadays in machines are quite critical when you're looking at conversation. But yet, if I pick up on a modern day philosopher, I don't know if that's a good way of describing Roger Penrose, one of his comments here is there is a great deal of randomness in the human brain's wiring. I mean, to me, this is simply not true.
I don't think he means you have random behaviour. I think he means the wiring is random.
He probably does. It's like saying in the Colossus, the wiring is random, which it's not. Maybe one point that we could all agree on is that Turing was making points to do with artificial intelligence 60-odd years ago that now are still being debated and discussed in a philosophical discussion about artificial intelligence. How can a machine be caught out? This is back to the Turing test. Well, one of Turing's statements to do with artificial intelligence, we put a defensive mechanism on as a human. The machine can be seen to be intelligent, but it can't make a cup of tea, or it can't do this. And he called this his argument to disability. It can do all these things, but it can't do this that a human can. I've picked out one of those that you could use, just for example, that is have a sense of humour. Machines can be very, very intelligent, but never have a sense of humour. And in fact, I've picked up on what Rickman said, that computers, whatever artificial intelligence they may display, cannot make jokes. Some of you probably are agreeing with that. So would humour catch a machine out if you're interrogating it? Let's see if it can tell jokes. These are actual responses during different interrogations. User is the judge. Okay, are you always right? This is from machine responses. Sometimes I'm left. User, how small is small, anyhow? Small. Yes, but exactly how small? Very small. So why don't you take over the world? I wouldn't know what to do with it. Anyway, I'm pretty busy already. And here's another one. This is a slightly naughty one, which is interesting. Again, from an actual transcript. I need to ask you if you've had a circumcision. Not a bad question. Ask then the question you need to ask me. Have you had a circumcision? It's been an average day. Not much happening on my end. And even the interrogator says, very witty. 2008, we held a whole set of Turing tests at the University of Reading, UOR. The winning machine on that day was Fred Roberts' Elbot, and Elbot then fooled 25%. Now remember, the pass mark we're looking for is 30%. And on that day, Elbot fooled 25% into thinking it was human. Yet, Elbot openly admits, if it's asked, that it's a robot. The interrogators, though, included software engineers, scientists, philosophers, journalists. Not really what you'd call average, but it's very difficult to achieve that. Ploys to try and find out which is which. Asking mathematical questions doesn't work. Machines aren't stupid. Machines are just as unlikely as a human to attempt to give a mathematical answer. In fact, you know, why should it? It would give it away. Perhaps it's better, perhaps, to ask topical, local questions to discuss the weather, that sort of thing, the colour of the walls. And the point is here not whether the machine is correct in an answer, it's whether it gives a sort of answer that a human would give, is the whole point. And not whether the human is correct, it's whether it gives an answer that a human would give. This is Elbot in action. Okay, fair enough, I'll stop with the slang, how are you? Just a moment, I'll start my self-diagnosis algorithm and let you know the results. Very funny, that's exactly what you'd say if you were a computer, right? There you go. And so this Elbot there was judged to be a human male. Again, this time Elbot judged to be a human adult male. It seems to me, with you human beings, the more proof there is of something, the less likely you are to believe it. Yeah, that's human nature, but you wouldn't know about that, would you? You're contesting, I think I got it right the first time. And then the judge says, has anyone ever told you that your hard work, wife maybe? So, I mean, he's not only a dull male, he's got a wife and he's got all sorts of things going into it. Turing said, average interrogator. What does that mean? You know, is it average? It's very difficult to bring all sorts of people in, probably never used a computer before and so on. I suspect even when the Turing test is officially passed, there will still be some people somewhere saying, no, it hasn't been passed because we didn't include somebody with a wooden leg who had once been to, you know, there'll be that, so it's not average. Even getting large numbers is very difficult in a practical test. And it is interesting how interrogators can be fooled but don't realise it. In the 2008 test, a Times reporter and an Oxford philosopher both subsequently reported, and the latter one in an academic paper, how easy it was to tell which was which. And yet both made incorrect decisions. The importance of the Turing test, it's very human-centric. It's human conversation. It's not machine conversation, which is what Turing picked up on. It's human communication only. This whole concept of understanding, which a lot of philosophers have picked up on, does the machine understand? That's not really, but does the interrogator understand? Does the hidden human understand? None of that is gone into. It certainly seems to be something of a milestone in AI. I think a key point is that it's great from a philosophical discussion point of view, and Turing was opening the whole point up way, way before we have the computers that we have now. It is very relevant to cybercrime of today, to fooling people, whether it be by machine or human, into thinking that something is worthwhile or it's not or so on. So it's very, very topical what we're looking at here. And it does, whether it's to do with their intelligence or otherwise, teach us a lot, not just about machines, but about humans, in terms of biases, preconceptions, the outward appearance. So all of these things are part and parcel of it. My thoughts, this personal thoughts, the Turing test likely will be, in some form, passed in the not-too-distant future. Hopefully, as Elbot got 25%, there's a numerical aspect. 1 week ago, the 100th anniversary of Turing's birth, we held here a whole series of Turing tests, which you've just had a go at one of the transcripts. This was in the qualifications to get to the final. The entity which was known to be a machine, and this is a quote from somebody who had been testing it out, It responded well to my greeting, expressing human-like emotions with words such as mood, fruitful and beautiful. The conversation flowed. I was asked where I came from and what was interesting about the place in which I live. It used some delightful human colloquialisms such as aha and oh. So this is from somebody who was testing at the qualification stage, knowing it was a machine at that time. The winner, Eugene, scored 29.17% deception rate. Didn't quite make it, but it's getting even closer. Dan Falk, who's a journalist, he was one of the interrogators, said a remarkably high score achieved by the winning chatbot. And yet, Eugene's score, in a sense, is not that remarkable. It didn't win in 2008, but it achieved 21%. And in fact, in the competition we held last week, the three of the machines were all pretty close together. Eugene won, but the other two machines were not far behind. So they're pushing and pushing. I think I'll leave it at that. We've created enough of a stir.
Well done.
Thanks for listening. Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or you can subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @bparkpodcast, or join the Bletchley Park Podcast Facebook group. We'd like to thank all of the speakers from this year's Turing Education Day, and especially the Alan Turing Centenary Committee for allowing us to bring you these talks. And of course, we must thank Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.